The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 142.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to today's live stream. I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona. I've got more of a, not really a permanent location, but I'm not going from Airbnb to Airbnb in Puerto Rico and St. Bart. So I'm kind of turning this little space into an office. I know there's quite an echo in here, so I apologize. Okay, guys, well, before we start, just remember to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's the online investment forum that'll help you make more money, make better decisions for your financial future. I partner up with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. They're absolutely amazing. We do live streams just like this for the members where myself, Lynn, and Chris answer your questions. So if you want to take your investing to the next level, make sure you check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. So let's get into your questions. Okay, we've got Sam asks, George, why does Sprott Physical Gold Trust graph look so much different than gold ETFs, iShares? Sam, I actually saw your question earlier and I looked up, I compared the Sprott Physical Gold Trust with the GLD and they're pretty much identical. So I don't know if maybe you're looking at like the Sprott maybe physical gold, like the miners, make sure that you're looking at PHYS, that's the ticker. And then make sure that you're looking at the exact same time frame. Maybe you're comparing a 6 month chart to a 1 year chart or a 2 year, I'm not sure what you're doing, but I looked at the GLD and Sprott and they were pretty much identical. Okay, Miguel, thanks for the super sticker and ass, been binging on Real Vision's Daily Brief for the last 2 weeks. It's a great podcast. I actually listen to that often myself. Any thoughts on Raoul Ash Friday comparison of America beginning to parallel Japan's current state of growth, lack thereof? Yeah, I mean, that's pretty consistent with Jeff Snyder's view as well. If you guys saw my interview with Jeff and Lynn the other day, that was super, super popular. That's probably one of the best interviews I've done, if not the best. So if you guys haven't checked that out, make sure you do. But that's Jeff Snyder's view that we're just going to kind of go into this Japanification. And I think Dr. Lacey Hutt would echo those sentiments. And I get it. I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you look at the overbearing debt and the lack of ability for the central banks to get enough money and enough velocity going in the real economy to actually create this the level of inflation they want. I'm not going to say create inflation because I think that, I know that consumer prices have gone up over the last, since the mid 1930s. So even the people that argue for quote unquote deflation, they're not really arguing for deflation. They're like Lacey Hunt has been in the disinflation. So just inflation, the rate of inflation going down, not necessarily going into deflation. And in the future, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I'm saying he's had that view since, I believe, the mid-1980s. And you could argue that he's been right, even if you think the CPI is cooked, because although we've had what I would argue higher inflation than they would let us on to believe, you could argue that it could be going down maybe from the 20% level at the end of the 1970s down to maybe call it 5% or whatever you think it might be today. So I think really it goes back to the whiteboard video I did on the commercial banking system and looking at not necessarily M2 money supply, but look at the amount of currency units that can chase goods and services. Because that's really the question you're trying to ask or you're trying to answer is, are the costs of goods and services going to go up in the medium term or long term? And to do that, I think we get really, we talk about base money, we talk about bank reserves, we talk about the primary dealer banks and then buying at auction and then QE and all these things. But really what it boils down to is how many currency units are actually in the real economy chasing goods and services. And to come to that conclusion, you have to look at the commercial banking system's liabilities. What are their liabilities? Those are checking deposits. Those are deposits that you and other entities and businesses have with Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you name it, the commercial banks. So those are their liabilities. So if those liabilities are increasing, then that means there's more currency units that are able to chase goods and services, then it's a matter of velocity. But we can really kind of get confused if we try to figure out everything, but I think if you just get hyper-focused on that, like I was talking about in that whiteboard video, you're gonna have a better idea what the probabilities are of a certain outcome coming to fruition, whether that's a deflationary deleveraging or an inflationary deleveraging. George is rolling craps at the MGM. No, I'm not in Vegas anymore. No, I'm actually here in Phoenix helping out a friend. So it's kind of unexpected, but I wasn't planning this trip, but I'll be here for the next few months at least. So I actually rented a place near where I used to live, just right off basically I'm on, I won't say where I am, but I'm very close to where I used to live when I was here in Phoenix several years ago. Okay. Question. Hi, George. How exactly do you prefer to own your gold? Yeah, just physical. But right now I haven't been able to get physical because I've been traveling so much. So just for the 10% allocation that I put towards physical gold, I've just been buying Rick's product, the Sprott Physical Gold Trust. So it's not ideal, but when I kind of get a more permanent living situation and I'm able to store the gold, maybe in a, who knows, I'll bury it in the backyard, or I'm not gonna go into where I store gold, but that's probably not a good idea. But when I get a little bit more permanent living situation, I'll go back to buying the actual physical stuff that you can sit and hold in your hand. But until that time, I'm pretty comfortable buying Rick's product. And by the way, on that note, I've just sold a property I had in Ecuador. So I'll be getting another, call it 100,000, something like that. So what I thought would be fun to do with that 100,000 is to set up a portfolio that everyone can see and just tell you exactly what I'm buying. And then maybe we can just track it or something like that. Or maybe that's something fun I could put in the forum for Rebel Capitalist Pro. So I see Arthur right here and Eric. So Arthur and Eric, I know you guys are members. I'll see you on the member live stream here in a couple hours, but let me know if you guys would get a kick out of that in the member forum. If I just took $100,000 and allocated it and showed you guys where I was putting the money in, we just have a little model portfolio, kind of like what Lynn does. Question, is physical gold a better investment than the gold miners? It's a completely different investment, Michael. They're not, I think they're apples and oranges, because physical gold, I buy that personally for insurance. It's just to maintain your purchasing power. Like we always say, I don't think it's a good idea to buy gold to get rich. I think it's a good idea to buy gold to stay rich. And that's applicable to whether you're rich or not. Just bottom line is you buy gold to maintain your purchasing power. Where miners are more of a speculation. So for those of you who don't watch a lot of my videos, I like to compartmentalize my portfolio into three categories. One is insurance, that's physical gold. It's just it's a way to protect your purchasing power against maybe some cash that you have and devaluing against inflation for a lot of different reasons though. And then you've got 80% of your portfolio that you allocate towards investing or investments. And I would define that as something that pays you to own it. It's like a dividend paying stock, real estate. Then you've got 10% of the portfolio, which I would call it speculation. So you're looking at something that's just what you feel has a lot of asymmetry, very little downside, a lot of upside. I would put the gold miners in the speculative category, where I'd put physical gold in the insurance category. So not that one's better, they just serve different purposes in my mind. Okay, oh, Charles is in Medellin. Very cool, Charles. Say hi to everyone for me. When you go down to, if you're in Provenza or Parque Arias or anywhere around there, got a lot of my projects, a lot of my employees live right around there. Okay. Did I check, Rob's asking if I checked the real estate in Vegas. Well, my mom's a real estate agent in Vegas. And if you guys want to use her services, she's the same last name. Her name is Betty Gammon. So you can look her up and tell her that you got her information on one of my live streams. I'm sure she'd love to talk to you about real estate or anything like that. But it's just not cheap. That's all I can really say about it. I mean, I might like Vegas real estate better than California, but that doesn't mean that I'm a big buyer. I just don't like looking at things and trying to predict whether they're going to go up or down in price. I think that's kind of a fool's game, but that's the game everyone tries to play, ironically. All I try to do is just look at it, is it cheap or is it expensive? And I think that Vegas housing, or most housing in the United States right now, is expensive. Therefore, I'm not a buyer. And as a matter of fact, I might be a seller. I'm thinking about selling the rest of the remaining properties that I have in Kansas City. As most of you know, I was just buying there hand over fist in 2012. I put almost 100% of my net worth into real estate back then. I didn't know what I was doing. Probably not a good idea, but I did it anyway. Fortunately, I made a lot of money as a result of that. But as of about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I started selling a couple of the properties. I held a few, but even the few that I still have, I'm thinking about selling those. And not that the prices won't go up. I'm not saying that I'm doing that because I think the prices are going to crash. I'm just doing it because I think the prices are expensive right now.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Okay, Stack09 asks, George, if we are now in a zero reserve system, how can Fed juicing dealer bank reserves make any difference in terms of credit availability in the real economy? Can't they lend at will? It's kind of just window dressing. I mean, even when we had a 10% reserve requirement, they could just borrow their reserves and they just, I mean, it's not like someone comes in for a mortgage and you go to your local B of A for a mortgage and they're like, oh yeah, well, boy, you got an 800 credit score. Ooh, that looks good. Let me talk to my manager here to make sure that we've got enough reserves to go ahead and create more money and give you a loan. No, they're not going to do that. If they think they can make money on the loan, they're going to do the loan. They're going to create new money. They're going to create new currency units. And then they're going to be like, okay, well, we got to find some reserves to meet our capital requirement or our reserve requirement. So now we're just going to borrow some in the overnight funding market or something like that. I don't think there was ever really too much of a restriction on them, on how much they could lend. At least it hasn't been that way for many, many years, especially. And then, of course, when they started doing QE, that went straight out the window because the excess reserves went over $1 trillion. And now the excess reserves, I think, are over $3 trillion. So there is absolutely nothing that would prevent them from creating a $250 billion worth of loans, other than the fact that they just would have to find the people that they think are capable of paying them back. And I would argue, especially with the Cerveza sickness, that that's getting far and fewer between. And also, too, a lot of people look at the banks, just their willingness to lend. But I think we forget about people's willingness to borrow. Like that's somehow infinite. And I don't think that it is. I think that people are restricted by income. And I think that people are also restricted by what they see happening around them and their risk tolerance. So if they see all these businesses going out of business and they have to wear masks everywhere and they go to the grocery store and everything's being sprayed down, it's not exactly a feeling of like, wow, I think the economy is going to boom here. I'm going to go out and take on some more debt because I think we're all going to get rich and this is going to be fantastic. I don't know that people are feeling that way. So I think it's you got to look at the supply side of lending, but you also have to look at the demand side, which I don't think people do often enough. But my whole point is they can lend at will. They have been able to for a long, long time. So there's nothing that really constrains the banks from creating quite literally infinite money, other than that they're just being enough people or enough demand for those loans and then them feeling like they could make money off those loans. George, have you been to Costa Rica? If so, good place to live, great tax benefits. I've not been to Costa Rica. It's all about what you like. I mean, I don't really like Costa Rica as far as living, because I just like nice things every once in a while. And it's not to say that Costa Rica doesn't have nice houses and nice resorts and stuff like that. But when I talk about nice stuff, I'm talking about, like, you're not going to be able to go out to the local symphony or go to a theater in Costa Rica or something where you would in New York. Now, it's not to say I would like to live in New York, but places like Medellin, as an example, they have all that stuff. You can go to any, as upscale as you want to get, you got it right there in Medellin. And, but then you got the benefit of everything else that goes along with it. Where in Costa Rica, I mean, if you really like the beach life and kind of the surfer vibe and everything, then I'm sure you'd love it. But I would argue, why go to Costa Rica when you could go to Ecuador? I mean, live way cheaper than Costa Rica. And, or you could go to, I mean, Colombia. I'd go to Santa Marta before I'd go to Costa Rica, you know, something on the Caribbean there. But I think there's just, if you like that type of vibe, there's probably places where you could do it that would be a bit cheaper. I'm not sure the great tax benefits, because unless you hand in your passport, your U.S. passport, assuming you're U.S., maybe you're not a U.S. citizen, but assuming you're a U.S. citizen, the only place you're going to get a big tax break is in Puerto Rico, because it's, you still have to pay U.S. taxes. So I'm not sure what you're referring to there, but I don't want to be a downer on it. I think it's a great place and you may love it, but you just got to make sure that you like that beach kind of rustic type of lifestyle. And if you do, then you'd probably love it. But then I'd argue there might be some places that are a little bit better just due to the cost of living. So Helsinki asks, can all the debt be forgiven? Well, not all the debt. I mean, if you're talking about, how could I define this? If you're talking about the debt on the Fed's balance sheet, then, I mean, technically it can be forgiven. But then I don't know that anyone has had a better point on this than Peter Schiff when I interviewed him last time. Actually, I was in Puerto Rico. I was lucky enough to talk to Peter for about an hour on the phone. And great conversation. The conversation was pretty much identical to an interview that I would have with him. What's funny is a lot of times people accuse Peter of getting on there and, you know, just, oh, of course he likes gold because he's got a gold company. So of course he's just talking his book or whatever. But listen, Peter, you got to ask what comes first, the chicken or the egg. And my point is, I think Peter was a big fan of gold and hard money and Austrian economics far before, long, long, long before he started his gold company. That was just a byproduct. A lot of people think it's in reverse order. But I mean, you talk to Peter on the phone, he's talking about gold. He's talking about Bitcoin. He's talking about the markets. He's talking about it's just, and I'm doing the exact same thing. So there's no, you're not putting on a show, that's for sure. It's, if you went to dinner with me, or I would assume if you went out to dinner with Peter, you're going to be talking about the exact same stuff that I talk about on my videos or he talks about on his podcast. So it's just what we really enjoy, and you can tell. So not sure if I answered the question there, I'm sorry, but that just kind of some insight. Okay, do I ever watch Mark Moss? Yeah. I didn't see his interview with Jeff. Mark's a great guy. Another guy I spoke with on the phone for probably a couple hours when I was in Vegas. We were talking about doing a meetup when I'm here in the United States, either doing one in Phoenix or SoCal where he is, maybe both. So look out for that in the future. Mark and I will probably, or most likely, do something, some sort of collaborative meetup thing within the next couple months when I'm here. I'm good. So yeah, I watch Mark. He's a great guy. I've got a ton of respect for what he does. He's just a fan, phenomenal YouTuber, and he's got his head on straight for sure. Okay. So Peter had a great point, my interview with him, and that was if they were to do a debt jubilee, that they couldn't shrink the balance sheet. I don't think anyone's ever thought about that, or at least I haven't heard people talk about that. That's a big deal, because think about that. If the Fed's assets are what they buy and sell to increase base money or bank reserves, how does that happen if they don't have anything to sell, right? How do they reduce base money if they can't sell any treasuries or mortgage-backed securities? They can't. They might be able to raise interest rates through IOER, but I don't know how you reduce bank reserves. And it'd be a logistical issue there for sure. But I don't know. And all the, also too, I mean, corporate debt, they can't do that unless the Fed owned all the corporate debt. But then you'd have to try to ask yourself, I mean, how would the repo market function if there's no collateral? Because what they're using for collateral in the repo market is debt. They're using treasuries. They're using mortgage-backed securities. That's debt. So it's someone's debt, another person's asset. So if all that just poof went away, I don't know how the dollar funding markets work. And if the dollar funding markets don't work, repo doesn't work, and the whole system just... It's like taking all the oil out of an engine. It'll just stop. I mean, that would be complete and total collapse. Is there not a flaw in the dollar milkshake theory by not accounting for non-US companies also raising prices, relieving the dollar shortage? Or is it simply the stage after the strong dollar? So let's see, let me think that through here. So you got kind of for non-US companies also raising prices. I mean, are you talking about non-US companies raising the prices of what they sell and denominated in local currency to generate more currency to buy the dollars? I don't think they're going to do that. If you think about the natural course of a business in a free market, it's the lower prices. Because you up the prices, your competitor is going to lower it, and all the people are going to go to the competitor. And if they don't have the dollar debt, then you go out of business. So I don't know if there's a lot of pricing pressure, if there's a lot of pricing leverage that those companies would have, and with the ability to do that, they're not monopolies. So, I mean, that might work on paper, but in practice, I don't think that would work. Okay, question, thoughts on Tesla Battery Day? I have no idea. I'm not sure what Tesla Battery Day is. It sounds like something that Elon thought up to as a PR stunt. So why has your blockchain dialogue surrounded current digital currency rather than decentralized finance and currency? People being their own banks changes monetary system? I mean, maybe. I don't know that it changes the monetary system. I mean, back in the 1800s, as an example, if you had a bar of silver, you could take it in and just get it minted into coins. So I'm not sure by people being their own banks. I'm guessing you're saying it would change the monetary system because people could create their own money by creating additional loans, and that wouldn't be on the shoulders of the banking system. But I don't know. I mean, I don't talk about stuff like that too much because I like to talk about what's actually happening right now, as opposed to what might happen in the future. I mean, if they start doing that, I'll do a whiteboard video on kind of how the system works. But you'll notice my whiteboard videos, though, usually aren't me making a prediction, or they're not me saying, hey, this is going to happen in the future. It's me saying, hey, here's a view of what may happen in the future, and here's how it works. This is how it functions. This is how it could play out. This is, let's say, Luke Groman. This is why he is saying that he is bearish on the dollar, or in Brent's case, you know, with the dollar milkshake theory. This is Brent's theory, and this is how it works to help you better understand it. And then you come to your own conclusion. So it's not that I don't like it. I think it's really cool and fascinating, but it just hasn't fit into a current topic. Maybe that's not to say that I won't do it in the future, but this week, I think I'm going to do one on a whiteboard video on the euro dollar market, and then one more pertaining to what's going on right now regarding the real economy and the divergence between the real economy and the stock market. Okay, Armando, thank you for the super sticker, my friend. That's very kind of you. The best place for the average Joe to retire, non-American citizen. Well, I don't think you're going to do any better than Medellin. I know I say that all the time, but I mean, the weather's perfect. The food is fantastic. The people are great. And the cost of living is just, I'm almost zero. And you've got a developed town. I mean, great infrastructure, a lot of public transportation. You've got entertainment. You've got nightlife. You've got the coast within a 45-minute flight, the Caribbean. You've got Cartagena. You've got all these cool places. And if you're bringing in, I mean, $2,000-$3,000 a month in retirement benefits, and you're living like a king down there. So out of all the places I've been, that would definitely be at the top of the list. And you're in a U.S. time zone to boot, and you're 3.5-hour flight from Miami. Question, when and why will Las Vegas housing prices drop? I don't really answer when questions. Those aren't answerable, in my opinion. And why? I don't think I can really answer that question either. Why? It's when supply exceeds demand. That's why it'll go down. But I don't know why and where. Again, I don't try to answer those questions. I think those are not really a good use of your time. I think it's more at answering a question of whether something's expensive or cheap. And question, where do you see the short-term and long-term real estate market going? That's a question of where the real estate is. There's a lot going on with that question. It's not really just a blanket statement. I mean, I would say over the next 10 years, I see prices going back down to their 2012 levels, but adjusted for inflation. So meaning that nominal prices could go up over the next 10 years, but real prices adjusted for inflation and size could go down. I think we had a trend line there going back to 1900 when you adjust for size and inflation, and wages haven't gone up. And the last time I checked, you still need an income to have a mortgage, or you need an income to have to make a mortgage payment. And I get it, interest rates can go down, yada yada yada. But still, at the end of the day, it's going to be predicated upon, to a certain degree, on income. And if incomes aren't going up in real terms, I don't see how prices continue to do so, unless we have a complete shutoff of all supply due to government regulation. And that could be. We could face that type of situation, but I don't think we're there yet. So again, I don't know that they'll go down in nominal terms, but in real terms, adjusted for inflation in the next 10 years, I would be surprised if we hadn't got back down to that historic trend line. So that means housing prices at the same level they were in 2012 or in 1998, right around there. Where are you currently positioning commodities, gold? Yeah, I think commodities are cheap right now. Like I said, with that $100,000 that I'm getting from the sale of that property, if it goes through, then I'll probably just keep that set aside just to allocate specifically to show everyone in Rebel Capitalist Pro. But that's what I'll be looking at. I mean, obviously I'll take 10% of that by gold. But with the commodity component, I'll be looking at that because it's cheap right now. So I'm guessing a lot of that $100,000 will probably go to commodities. We'll see. Okay, outside of Colombia, which countries do you see are on the strongest trajectory of freedom and treating investment capital well? I mean, I agree with Chris McIntosh that it's tough in the developed world. I'm not overly optimistic. I like countries that are more kind of on that longitude of Russia. So that's like kind of the old Eastern European countries, Georgia, Tbilisi is really kind of everyone's talking about that right now in digital nomad community. I think there's a lot of neat opportunity in Africa. That's another place that I might look to invest with a couple of funds that I know of that look at Africa specifically. Then the Middle East, I think there's going to be some opportunity there longer term. And we might still go to Dubai And I'm very excited about real estate in Dubai. So I think those types of that area is going to be moving more towards free market capitals. And they might not be there now, but I think they're going in the right direction, where I think most of the developed world is going the opposite direction. And I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. That's the best way I can say it. I don't like to say that because I like the U.S. I like being here. I got a lot of friends and family here, obviously. But I don't see how it gets better without going through a lot of significant changes that we know are politically unpalatable. So they're just going to keep kicking the can down the road. And it's unfortunately going to get worse because any of their quote-unquote solutions just exacerbate the problem. So David asked, George, is it true that Colombia taxes worldwide income? Yeah, it is. But that's why you don't want to be a tax resident there. So it's they still tax you as a resident. They don't tax you as a citizen like the U.S. So what that means is if you're a citizen of the U.S., then if you go to Hong Kong or you go to Dubai, where let's say Dubai, where there's zero tax, and you're there for 20 years and you never step foot again in the United States, you still pay U.S. tax because you're still a citizen of the U.S. Now, if you were a citizen of Colombia and you went to Dubai for 20 years, you would not pay Colombian taxes. But if you went back to Colombia and you were there more than 6 months, so for that tax year, you're technically a resident of Colombia, then yes, they would tax you on your worldwide income. But that is a lot different than what the United States does. And so having said that, if you've got a significant amount of income that you don't want to have taxed, the answer is just don't spend more than 6 months a year in Medellin. Simple. Just go other places to make sure that you're dividing your time to where you're not a tax resident of any one place. Usually that's they say kind of the 6 month mark is the line in the sand for that. Is Act 20 and 22 sustainable? I mean, a year ago, I would have said absolutely. 3 weeks ago, I would have said absolutely. Until I went to Puerto Rico this last time. And those of you who follow me on Twitter know know exactly what happened when I went to Puerto Rico. Quite a bit of drama there for sure. I think if you get Act 20 and 22 is a contract between you, the entrepreneur, and the Puerto Rican government. I think if you get that, I don't know that they're going to go back and take it away. I think they may stop it. They may stop doing it for in the future for individuals, but I don't know that they would, if you already had a contract, an Act 20 and 22 contract, if they would go back on it or they would say, oh, no, we're going to retroactively tear this up and you're going to owe us the taxes for when you were here. I don't see that happening, but maybe a year or two down the road, they might just stop doing them. In which case you'd want to get there right now and get that contract so you don't have to worry about it. But as far as them keeping it on the books long-term, as far as just issuing new Act 20 and 21 Act 20 and 22 contracts, I'd like to say it is, but I don't know. I'd give it probably a 60-40. It's like 60% chance that it will be sustainable. And sustainable meaning that they're going to continue to issue them, not sustainable meaning that they're going to go back and take them away. But and then maybe a 40% chance that they stop doing them.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Okay, so Meg is asking, do you still keep your asset in Singapore? I haven't really talked about Singapore too much on the channel. I don't have any assets there. I've been in Singapore a lot prior to retiring. Prior to 2013 or so, I retired in 2012, and I used to spend a lot of time there, but I never had any assets there. So might be some confusion. Okay, question, why do rich people discredit what real inflation is to the lower income people? Food, utilities, basic living is rising, but non-essentials going down. What's that? Isn't that what inflation is? I don't know that they're discrediting it. I don't know that they see it as easily as normal people, because you know, if other people are doing your shopping, if you're not too fixated on it, then you're not really going to notice things. And it all depends on what you buy too. You know, so rich people spend a lot larger percentage of their income on things that go down in value. And then where poorer people in the middle class spend more of their income as far as a percentage on things that go up in price. I said value, I shouldn't have said value, I meant price. So it affects the different individuals in a non-linear way. But I think that's really what I would say. It's just probably through personal experience. Okay. So question, have I already talked about the new banking license that they are giving out to crypto platforms? I've not talked about that, but I've heard a couple people go back and forth on Twitter on it. So maybe it's something I'll look into next week. Now, Luke asked, does cash actually exist in a digital world where everything is in interest-bearing loan or deposit? And there are no pure non-liability forms of payments for debts. The only thing I know is it's a non-liability form of payment for debt would be gold or Bitcoin, maybe. I don't think anything else is fiat. So everything else is a promise to pay. It's not actually a payment. Opinion on Open Door disrupting the need for real estate agents? Maybe. I'm very skeptical about new technology in real estate because, I mean, I can't tell you how long I've been hearing people talk about how this new app or this new technology is going to revolutionize property management. And I'm not saying that you're saying that. You know, you're talking about something different. But I'm using that as an example. They always say, oh, this is going to revolutionize property management. I'm always like, okay, I hope so. But at the end of the day, property management is just, it's you're dealing with people. And I don't think you're going to be able to get around that. And it's really tough because you got the tenants, you got to manage them, you got to manage them making their payments. And then on the flip side of that coin, you've got to manage the workers going out to do the work. How do you monitor that? How do you micromanage it? And I just don't see an app solving those problems. And sure enough, every single time someone has told me about this brand new app that solves the property management problem, it never really pans out. So I think that real estate is just one of those things that it's just, it needs to be done face to face. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm totally clueless. Maybe I'm just some stupid old guy that just doesn't get technology. But I don't really see it happening too soon. Okay, so Michael asks, when are you going to have Lynn on again? She's got insight. Yeah, she's amazing. I'll have Lynn on soon. But just as a reminder, she's on almost every week in the Rebel Capitalist Pro. She has. We use her research papers in our forum, and we do live Q&As with myself and Lynn every, not every Tuesday, but every other Tuesday. So If you're a huge fan of Lynn, definitely check out Rebel Capitalist Pro at georgegammon.com/pro. When am I getting Klaus on? Eric, that's funny. Yeah, I need to interview Klaus for sure. From the, if you guys don't, that's an inside joke. I did a video on the World Economic Forum, and Klaus is the guy that runs the thing. He's straight out of a James Bond movie. He's like an evil villain in James Bond, but he's real. I mean, it's shocking. But yeah, that would be an interesting conversation. Okay, this is a good question. Can you explain why the Fed can offer unlimited liquidity to institutions, but not individuals? Well, the main reason is because those institutes, they're doing it through the banking system, and the banks have accounts with the Fed. So the Fed can create bank reserves and just put those in the accounts of the banks, and then those banks do business with these huge corporations, and they're incentivized to do these loans and or bailouts and whatnot for these big businesses because they make a lot of money. It's worth their time. It's not really worth their time to deal with just the average Joe, because why would they work on a loan for $10,000 when it takes them the same amount of time and energy to do a loan for $10 billion to American Airlines, something like that. So the Fed really doesn't have a transfer mechanism to provide liquidity. They have to use the commercial banking system to provide the liquidity. And then the Fed will come in and say, okay, Wells Fargo, if you extend a loan to XYZ business, then we'll go ahead and we'll backstop 95% of the loan. So they go, okay, they'll do that. But it's still, you're putting in a middleman, where if you've got direct access to the Fed, then boom, instantly tomorrow morning, you can have those bank reserves just right in your account or your bank or, you know, something like that. And they get bailed out. And it's really like, it's the Cantillon effect, in the sense that the people that are closest to the money are the people that get it first. And they're the ones that really benefit from the additional base money or bank reserves being created, where once it gets a step removed, two, three, four, five steps removed, then all of a sudden those people or those entities aren't getting any money. They're not getting liquidity. They're not getting bailouts. It's only the cronies that are right next to the politicians and the people at the Fed or the primary dealer banks. But the main reason is that the Fed doesn't have a transfer mechanism. Even if they did, they probably wouldn't utilize it. But I'm not going to say they can only do this, because in the future, I'm sure they'll expand what they can and can't do. But currently, really, the only thing they can do is create bank reserves. And that's how they do that. That's how they control monetary, try to control monetary policy, is through the creation of those bank reserves. So if, the mom and pop Subway or sandwich shop on the corner, if they don't have an account at the Fed, then there's really nothing the Fed can do to bail them out, other than the Fed going to Wells Fargo and saying, hey, Wells Fargo, if you give them a loan, then we will backstop a certain percentage of that. But then then you have to go through the mom and pop. They have to go through Wells Fargo. They have to go through their underwriting process, where if you're American Airlines, or if you're like a primary dealer bank, if you're Fannie and Freddie, and you need a bailout from the Fed, you're just, Jerome, hook me up. And he just goes, dip, 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 dip. Okay, you got an extra $1 trillion in your account. You're good to go. Or they go in there, they bail out American Airlines or maybe some junk company by buying their debt. It's the Cantillon effect. It's straight crony capitalism, really. Well, Chris, sure, I'll tell you about that. Chris asked, can you tell us a little about more? He's talking about Rebel Capitalist Pro. He said the benefits, really, it's an online forum. We've got, I'm not sure how many members right now, but it's just a small community of pretty like-minded individuals. They're people who value gold, Bitcoin. They like buying things when they're cheap. They're hard money, not big fans of the Fed or large governments, I would say, as a whole. And they're just looking to become better investors. They're looking for ideas, and then they're looking for the best quality research in the business. And that's why I partner up with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. They provide research for the Rebel Capitalist members, the Rebel Capitalist Pro members. and you can access that. Chris's stuff comes out once a week. Lynn's stuff comes out once every 2 weeks. And in addition to that, we do live stream Q&As just like this with Lynn and Chris and myself. So obviously there's not 1,000 people here like there normally is on my live stream. There's maybe 10, 20 people on a live stream, and then we take questions right from the forum. So it's a much more intimate type setting. And if you want to learn about how to become a better investor or learn more about gold, Bitcoin investing, or just learn how to make money by buying stuff that's cheap and selling it when it's expensive, more that value mindset, then you get a lot of value from Rebel Capital's Pro. And I definitely suggest checking it out, because right now, my digital marketing guy, Gene, set up a deal where it's $1 for a week trial. So you can't beat that. It's $1. Go on there, check it out. You'll love it. And even if you don't, you just don't renew it or do whatever it takes to just keep the subscription from moving forward. But you're going to love it. So anyway, that's my pitch to you for Rebel Capitalist Pro. I won't go on. We'll get back to the normal questions here. Question: property in South Africa. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, John. It might be cheap, but I should just say that's not the only requirement for me taking action. That's where I start, is by asking if it's cheap or if it's expensive. But once I'd established that it might be cheap, historically speaking, there still has to be a lot of things lined up. Now, I might like it in the future, but there would need to be a substantial catalyst to them changing the way they view free market capitalism in order for me to become interested in South Africa and start kicking tires. Would you debate Sam Cedar maybe on economics? He's this leftist on YouTube. Have you reached out to him? I'm not sure who Sam is. If so, did he ever get back to you? I have not reached out to Sam. I'm not sure who he is, but I would have no issue whatsoever debating anyone. I haven't really thought of it. I mean, I'm not that, as you guys know, the Rebel Capitalist Show isn't that type of show where I get in to try to burn people or whatever. It's more just trying to understand their views and become a more educated person. And it's really trying to get outside of the echo chamber that I feel it's so dangerous if we get into, even with Austrian economics or common sense economics, if you want to use that term. I don't think you should get into just or surround yourself by people who just agree with you. And so that's why I try to talk to a diverse range of people, including people that are really fit the mindset of the stereotypical or the individual, the demographic of the YouTube channel, if you want to look at it in those terms. So I try to get outside that box. So, but I'm not sure. I'd be happy to look into maybe interviewing Sam. If he wanted to do a debate, I have no problems doing a debate. But it's got to be their idea, though. I would never, dupe someone into coming on and say it's an interview. Then all of a sudden I try to turn it into a debate. Like I don't play those games at all. And, but I'm open to it. If he wanted to come on the show and just talk about his positions, or if he wanted to do a debate, I think that would be a lot of fun. Eric asks, what are your thoughts for the next 18 months, deflation, depression, and then what? I think that we're just going to have a gradual increase in inflation with consumer goods. So meaning the price of consumer goods going up. I think we're going to have long-term unemployment. Or high levels of unemployment, I should say. I think it'll hover around 8, 9, 10%. That'll be the headline, like the U3 number. U6, probably 12, 13. The real rate of unemployment, I think, will be around high teens. I don't think, it's like the CPI, they don't measure it correctly. If you dive into how they measure it, they definitely understate unemployment for sure. But I see us having kind of structurally long-term unemployment or high levels of unemployment while we have higher levels of consumer price inflation. Doesn't mean that we have hyperinflation or anything like that. And it doesn't mean that asset prices don't come down. And it doesn't mean that certain things in the economy don't deflate that require debt to purchase them, such as high-end vehicles. But I don't think that the stuff that you buy on a daily basis, if you're someone in the middle class or just kind of an average Joe or Jane, I don't see those prices coming down. And I see them going up. Maybe call it a 5% clip, maybe 5 to 7% clip if you're looking at the CPI. If you're not looking at the CPI, if you're looking at like shadow stats, then maybe we're up at 10%. So stagflation. Yeah. But just kind of minor stagflation. I don't see us getting into that hyperinflation mode that I think a lot of people are worried about. There's just, after talking with Jeff quite extensively about that the other day, I don't know that I'd be a dollar bull. I'm still kind of a dollar bear when you look at it in terms of goods and services. But I see that there's always going to be a bid out there for the dollar, at least over this short term, what you're talking about. And I don't know that I'm as bearish as I was, but that's just me personally. It doesn't mean that we're not going to 50 on the DXY by over a year. It's just a matter of probabilities. There are no certainties. But I just see kind of a lower kind of grind down with the dollar relative to consumer goods. In other words, a grind higher with consumer price inflation. What do I think of Exxon, Shell, Chevron? I mean, I think they're getting cheap again, so I'm looking. I'm not buying. But I think that if you look at Lynn's work, that she's pointed out a lot of other oil producers, more specifically in Russia, that could be even better buys. So when I was talking about allocating that $100,000 earlier, that's probably the very first place I'm going to look after I buy gold are some of these oil producers that are in Russia, Luke Oil being one of them. Okay, I think that's pretty much it, guys. Let's go ahead and do some shout outs. And like I was saying, check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. That is at George Gammon/pro. Check out that $1 for a week trial deal that Gene's got going on. Want to do shout outs for everyone here at the end. We've got Brendan, Arthur. Arthur, I'll see you in a couple hours, buddy. Joe Biden is here. Wow. Holy cow. might just be a username. We got Michael, we got 8-Bit Madness, I think. Ultimate Bargains, yes, we see him here all the time. Thanks for joining us on the live stream. Alan, Anomalia, I think is how we pronounce it. You're always here as well. Thanks for hanging out. We got Sass Crypto, Aaron, Eric Carlson, David, Rigo, Anonymous, Crypto Ice, very cool logo, Kiro, Ocario Motto. Hi, Viz Economist. Hey, buddy. How you doing? It's good to see you. I've been traveling so much. It feels like I haven't done a live stream in weeks. So it's good to see all the usual suspects here. Science 2491, Mark Tur, Harvey, Bear, Chris, 77 Finn Bear, Diego, Tony, USA, 40 ounces. Jim, Mark, Bahamonic, I can't pronounce that one. Sorry, Robin, Sean, Ryan, Daniel, Mark, Jim. Okay, guys, I'm out. We'll see you guys on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.